Hey, let's be honest. Buying a car can be a stressful experience. But True Car is changing car buying forever. Yes, True Car helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Last month, over 45,000 cars were sold by the True Car Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar.com users save an average of $3,000 off manufacturer's suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. And I like easy. I'm very simple upstairs. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. And the third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Every day, TrueCar.com users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One gang, nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey folks, welcome to the podcast. This week, excited to have on the show Mick Foley, professional wrestler, known as Mankind. A really cool conversation with Mick about how he got started in wrestling, came up through the ranks, how he lost an ear in a fight. So there you go, if you stubbed your toe at work, put that in perspective. Really interesting conversation with him about his life as a wrestler and what he's doing now with his live touring show where he's telling stories from his life being a wrestler. Just really great insight. If you're not even into wrestling, you're going to find this interesting because it really gives you a really good insight into that world and what it's like to be on the inside. And come on out and check me out doing stand-up this week. I'm going to be in West Palm Beach, Florida at the West Palm Beach Improv May 29th to the 31st. May 29th to the 31st. And June 26th to the 29th, I will be in Hartford, Connecticut at the Hartford Funny Bone. All right. Thanks for checking out the podcast and follow me on Facebook and Twitter, Paul Mercurio. Thanks for checking it out.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
All right. Welcome to the podcast this week. I'm very excited. I've been wanting to have this guy on for a while. The great wrestler, Mick Foley, four-time world champ, 11-time tag team champion, and best-selling author of Have a Nice Day. Thanks for being on the show, buddy. It's great to have you.
Hey, I was thrilled to get the nod, Paul. I really appreciate it, and love talking about what I do, and
yeah.
Especially with a seasoned veteran like yourself.
Well, we kind of get to know each other at The Daily Show, and you've been on The Daily Show a few times, and I work on The Daily Show. Well, tell people how that came about, and because I didn't realize it until like the day of, and I walked in, and I'm like, oh my God, that's Mankind, that's Mick Foley.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I thought you were going to body slam me, so I kept I averted my eyes and looked down at the floor so you wouldn't kick my ass.
it's kind of a cool story. People at home might want to get a tissue out, a touching one. But John was being honored by the USO, so going back, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just managed, like, I wasn't on the list. I was there visiting troops, and I was going to the gala that John was going to be honored.
And where was this,
honored.
In New York?
This was in, Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And I heard there was, like, they were taking a little trip to the Arlington National Cemetery. And like I was like, hey, can I go? You know, just like this little tiny, you know, this van of 6 or 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
And John was on the van, and we kind of bonded over this. Really, one of these guys who's so on the surface so terribly disfigured, but who after 10 minutes makes you forget that there's even something different about him. Just a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the after party. I'm an observer of people, you know, and I went up to John and I said, John, I was kind of hesitant to talk to you. I said, because I'm a fan of the show. And he goes, oh, thanks a lot. And I said, no, like, yeah, understand, I'm a big fan. Like, I love this show. And I said, I was afraid that if I talked to you and you were, and then he filled in the blank, you know.
Yeah.
I said that it might suppress my ability to enjoy the show.
You were worried that you're the guy that you kind of maybe idolized or really looked up to was a dick, right? You were worried that he was going to be a dick.
I was worried that might be the case.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, man, I said, I've been on a lot of these trips. I said, and usually stars can't help but reveal, like, their spoiled nature, you know, like, even if they're not trying to.
Yeah.
They just can't help the pampering. And I said, man, I didn't see any of that. I said, I just saw a guy who wanted what was best for the troops. And then we started to, you know, it turned out we had quite a bit in common. And about a year later, I took my wife to a performance of to a Daily Show taping,
mm-hmm.
and the guys kind of let me in, just sit on the couch instead of waiting in line. And really, when John passed by and I said, "Hey, John," I thought I was going to get a "Hey, dude."
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
That's kind of customary from a guy who meets so many people,
right?
World leaders and things like that. And instead, he goes, "Man, what are you doing here?" You know, like, and he sat down. And he talked with. He talked with me and my wife for like 10 minutes. He's like, listen, I'm sorry, I got to go, but we got this show we're doing. I was like, literally stunned that he knew my name, let alone spend any time with us. So at the end of the show, he handed us, you know, those papers that he scribbles on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, months later, I guess in a writer's meeting, they had an idea for, a wrestler on the show. And, you know, the writers were pitching, you know, the current stars of WWE. And John, from what I'm told, said, you know what? He goes, I like Mick Foley.
Yeah.
A fan of the show. Maybe you were there for it. He goes, let's see if he's available.
Well, you came on as the senior ass kisser and defending pro-gay rights.
Defending the kid well, from Arkansas.
Yeah.
And I then later on found out that, you know, he was still being harassed by neighbors, and kept in touch with his dad for a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. and sent the kid well wishes. So that was a starter. Like, I've only been on, four times,
yeah.
once as a guest and three times, as part of the show, but you guys have a way of making people feel like family when they get there.
Yeah, John's a great guy, and that's the thing about him. He's really down to earth, and you have a lot in common with him. He was a wrestler on the Jewish circuit. He would kick the... He would get lawyers and doctors and accountants and just pummel the shit out of them. It was with guilt, though. He didn't use physical abilities. It was mind games. It was, you really going to hit me? Why would you want to hit me? A lot of that, you know. But you were great. And I remember the first time you were there, it was so funny because what stood out is, and I only mean this as a compliment, you have performed in front of thousands upon thousands of people and fallen from cages 20 feet in the air. And you're going into our little dinky studio with 200 people on this little cable show, and you looked really nervous. Like you looked,
I was a performer.
And you're very well spoken, and everybody, by the way, you left a great impression on everybody. Everybody thought you were the nicest guy. Other than that puppy that you ate, they thought that you were the nicest. No, everybody was like, "He's such a sweet guy." But I remember what stood out to me is, like, why would that guy be nervous? He's been
anytime you do anything live.
Yeah, that's
especially,
true.
Listen, you know, I'm not just blowing smoke. And I know Jerry Seinfeld did a great job of analyzing that entire sentiment of blowing smoke.
Right.
But, I mean, it's a really relevant show, you know, and it's a show, I loved. So it's a... And you've probably been in front of audiences, you know, small audiences. I mean, when I started doing these stand-up or spoken word shows,
mm-hmm.
there were some pretty tiny audiences because I could not talk to the same people who would wait in line for me to sign an autograph or a book
mm-hmm.
to come out and, you know, hear me tell stories. And there might be a small crowd out there, but it was kind of terrifying. It was like doing a pay-per-view wrestling show without the prospect of a late-night emergency room visit.
But people should know that go to realmickfoley.com and all your tour dates are up. You've got 50 tour dates through November. You're going to be doing some in Canada, and it's a really great show. I saw it in New York, and it's charming. It's funny. It's stories, but it's you and anybody who's a fan or not a fan. I think it's very really captivating. And one of the things that stands out with you, different than some of the other wrestlers, is your sense of humor. You know, in and out of the ring, and you incorporated that as your persona. Was that plan? You have Mr. Sacco and all of that, and like, how did that creep into your persona as a wrestler over the years? How did you come up with that?
I have to. If you hear somebody shouting, so I just came home with a couple of gifts from my son. He just got home from school.
Oh, that's
he's ecstatic. He doesn't even know about the big gift I got for him.
Has he got a birthday? What is it?
Yeah, go ahead and open it. No, I just I strike a mean deal. I struck very shrewd. Wait, hold on one
second.
Yeah,
sure.
Yes, yeah. He's now talking to me as I.
That's okay. How old is he?
He's 11. So remember Rocky when Burgess Meredith sees him with the Shamrock meat?
Yeah.
So Vinny goes. What's in it for you? He goes, Paulie gets $2,000, I get the rope. And Mickey goes, shrewd. So that's me basically doing their commercials for Ringside Collectibles in exchange for toys. Like, there's no monetary exchange. Like, yeah, I'll come by. I'll do your thing. I'll review all your toys. Just you got to give me free stuff. So he has no idea I have, like, the present, the top, all presents waiting for him.
Oh, yeah? Cool.
Yeah, what was the... I'm talking to somebody very important here, buddy. All right, yeah. What was the question anyway, Paul?
No, I was going to say, can you tell us one of the gifts that he did open that you brought him? What did you get him?
Yeah, this is a table, ladders, and chairs set with, like, the breakaway table.
Oh, cool.
So you can bring, put a wrestler up on a tall ladder. Oh, and the ladder breaks too. You know, breaks away the leg.
That's awesome.
So
you get him into the you get him into the family business.
Well, we've got this long running tradition where I will kind of sneak up on him. Every video ends the same way. I'll hear him playing in his room, and it's like I refer to it as the sounds of human agony. Where I'll wake up and all I hear is oh, right in the family jewels. You know, as he's doing his. commentary, and I'll come in with the camera because I want to, you never know when this age is going to end and when one day he's going to decide it's over. And every video ends the same way. It ends with him going, Dad, when he realizes
I'm taping him.
Why do you always tape it? I go, I love when you play. Like, I want to capture these moments. So
my son's a couple of years older than yours, and he gets so aggravated. I take so many pictures, and he's like, "I'm not taking another." I go, "Look over here." Then there's an argument. I'm like, "You're gonna want these later. You're gonna want these later." And
exactly.
Did I read that son is posting videos somewhere, or is that you doing that? Like, one of you doing one of your sons doing stuff on YouTube or something?
Yeah, the two of them have a YouTube channel.
That's great.
What's the address? Mickey Foley 0105, and they do some fun stuff and very creative editing. Although when they were celebrating their 1,000th subscriber, and they were like, "We're gonna celebrate it by what was the game you smashed?" Black Ops. A Black Ops game. They just took a baseball bat. It's like started smashing it with a bat. And I don't know where they got that from.
Oh, that's where would they get that kind of action from? Right.
Can I tell you something interesting that I'm involved with? And it resulted. Somebody asked me after the show in Tampa. He was like, "Hey, bro, I keep on saying, keep on tweeting you. Like, ask you give me a retweet. What's the deal?" And I said, "Let me tell you what I did to get a retweet from Zoe Deschanel." I said, "I dressed up like an elf for 7 days in what we call Foley is Elf Week." The last time I was on the show and I was interviewed by John. I was wearing my Santa shirt, and I mentioned I was working on a documentary about Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And so now my idea is if I wear something with Santa every day for 365 days, that by, October, November, the news people that may have taken a pass are going to be like, really, this guy's been wearing Santa every day. And he has proof of this, and so we're documenting it. So, you know, break up the monotony of just Santa. We had a Foley's Elf Week where every day I wore clothing from the movie or inspired. So we had a picture of me with the Son of a Nutcracker T-shirt taken with my sons and called it Sons of Son of a Nutcracker. And I sent out a tweet saying, you know, at Zoe Deschanel, will she retweet me or block me? And we got the retweet, and it was like, I'd really worked hard for that.
Nice,
week, you know?
Nice. Now, why Zoe? Are you just somebody that you would like stalk?
Well, she was in Elf. You know, hold on a second. My wife is Paul Mercurio. Baby birds outside in our nest.
Nice.
You know what? I she was a big part of Elf, which has become my favorite movie. And I think she's a funny, unique, charming performer.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, goes. I love people who go out on a limb, you know, and for their art.
Yeah.
And when I became a fan of Will Ferrell, for example. Keep in mind that his most of his years on Saturday Night Live took place when I was working every Saturday, so I wasn't that familiar with who this guy was. And of course, there's that famous cowbell, you know, more cowbell, segment. But what got me was how hard he was willing to work. Like, he was really working that cowbell.
Committed. He commits to it 100%.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, so I enjoy that. Like, you know, if a wrestler, no matter how ridiculous the premise may be, you know, a guy named Edge, for example, I said, like, he embraced the ridiculous. You know, like, he thrived on the dramatic and the big matches, but also, like, you gave him a ridiculous premise, he wasn't going to say, oh, this is terrible. He's going to say, how can I make this as ridiculous as possible? And I'm just going to kind of circle back to your question, like, where did this stuff come from? Is actually there's a infamous match called Hell in a Cell that took place in 1998 that resulted in
in Pittsburgh.
Exactly.
And that was everybody says, like, that was like one of the most physically brutal matches. Like, you guys really went at it. Tell people a little bit about that. Give me a little backstory on that.
Well, there was a second ever what we in the house call Heck in a Cell. My son heard me say the double hockey stick word for the first time. Huey, how many times have you heard dad curse in your entire life? Not including my shows.
No,
I thought it was one.
Well, you're a better man than I am.
Oh, well, the F-bomb. How many F-bombs have I dropped that you've heard in the house in your life? Zero. See?
Wow.
No, one when I yelled at my older son. Actually in the house. This is one.
Right.
It was outside. And I specifically remember it. And that's why I like save up. When I do my show, I only drop one.
Right.
And I make it like the crescendo. And if I do my job right, I'll get a standing O on the one F-bomb, which brings me every bit as much joy as like holding a world heavyweight championship aloft.
Nice.
But on that night in Pittsburgh, you know, we were trying to live up to the standards, you know, that have been set with the previous Cell match. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was not the athlete that Shawn Michaels was. You know, he was able to climb and hang and do these things. And so I came up with the great idea to start the match on top of this, you know, Cell structure, which was massive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after I was thrown off, and I did learn in the United Kingdom not to say tossed off.
Mm-hmm.
It gets a chuckle there instead of a wince. It means a little something different there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we continued on, and you know, what I say in my shows is that, like, at least I had the peace of mind of knowing, like, absolutely knowing that the worst part of my evening was over with. And
What is that like when you're up there? I think I read it was like 16 or 18 foot drop.
It was a legit 16. I'll tell people, like, say it's estimated to be 40, but it was a legit 16, and people will laugh. And I go, listen, once you've been thrown off a surface 6 feet higher than the basketball rim, like, you don't need to exaggerate anymore. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You've really done that. And I was glad that one of my co-workers, a guy named Chris Jericho, who once lasted an entire week on the reality show Duets, that he mentioned in his book, you know, that he was thinking of coming off the Cell, and he said, he went up there and he said, I don't want to exaggerate this, but the people looked like ants. And I was so glad that, I was so glad he said that because, you know, one of the biggest lies I've ever told in my life is when I assured Mr. McMahon that I had been up on top of the cell earlier in the afternoon. I was completely comfortable up there. And the truth is, if I'd ever gone up on top of that cell.
That's hilarious. That's like everybody who has an interview lies about something. Most people go like, have you ever gone over accounts receivable before? Yes. In your case, it's like, yes, I've thrown myself off of 20 feet of 20-foot drop. Now, when you drop 16 feet like that, were you landing on a breakaway table? Or
it was a legit table. It broke because it was going to break, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know.
But how does your body withstand that? How were you – how does it
– Well, you know – That was a really, really extreme measure, and it was a calculated risk. What we didn't know is that when we got back, you know, climbed back up on top of the thing, it was like what you talk about, you know, from the penthouse to the outhouse. You know, I rolled off of that stretcher and I started climbing, and it was like this just rush of adrenaline. And then the Undertaker choke slammed me up on top of the cell. And to this day, people debate whether I knew it was going to give or not. And I'm like, trust me, I would take credit for it if I knew. Like, it would have been the gutsiest thing ever. But
I thought it was staged that it gave way.
It just boom, it gave way. And you know, it was you know what I call like the irony of pro wrestling is that at least in 1998, it's the sport that everyone knows is show business and whatnot, but it's also the sport that continues when one of the participants is no longer conscious.
That's a good point. I never heard it put that way.
Wait, hold on 1 second.
Yeah.
What, did he see it?
Yeah.
Hey, tell him to go ahead and open it. All right.
So you don't want
to
wait?
Yeah, wait, tell him to wait until I get out there. Yeah, I landed. It's an amazing ring. It's like one of the. It's not even on sale yet, so it was worth like the extra 3 hours it spent me.
What
shrewd bargain. It's like a.
What is it?
A new WWE ring. You know, it's much bigger than the other one. It's like triple the size of the other one. So,
wow.
You know, it's cool. You can reenact like when I lost my ear in Germany. You can relive a lot of these cool moments.
When you lost your ear in Germany, was that something that was planned, or how did that?
Nah, that wasn't in the script. That was an ad lib on the part of the ropes.
Like, do you have a conversation with him afterwards, going like, dude, what are you doing? You took my ear. Like, what? Talk about that.
No, you know what? It was like I was dealing with a kind of limited physical hand, and so like I had to. Go to lengths, and I did try to protect myself. Like on that night in question, like when I asked the ring announcer what the ear looked like, he goes, "Well, it looked like a piece of uncooked chicken with tape on it." So it actually had the tape because I knew I was doing the move, and then you know, looking back in time, like I probably should have taken that off the menu, a couple of years earlier.
Yeah,
I'd ended up in emergency rooms a couple times because of it. Yeah. And that night, you know, the ropes were just really tight, and sometimes you create the illusion by actually, when I was younger, I was 19 and got into it, I was really fascinated by the moves that had no loopholes. You know, like, all right, I know how they do most of that, but I don't know how that guy does that, Matt, and that move. Like,
so you were really studying this. For people who don't know, I mean, the story is that you hitchhiked to Madison Square Garden to see Jimmy Snuka in a handicap match against Don
Morocco.
And that's kind of where you fell in love with it, and you went to high school with Kevin James, and you were a wrestler.
Did, yep.
You were on the wrestling team. Now, did you see yourself maybe going, being a Greco-Roman wrestler and going to like the Olympics, or did you know?
Because I was a huge pro wrestling fan, and to this day,
Sammartino. Did you like Bruno Sammartino?
I like Bruno growing up. To this day, it's hard for me to fathom that Bruno actually likes me. You know, our styles were so different.
I think.
But yeah, I did. I went out for the team, and if someone had stopped me and said, "Hey, you know that Kevin James is the heavyweight," like I probably would have. Oh yeah. Going out for that team would not be a good idea because Kevin was a tough kid and one of only two guys at our high school who bench pressed 300 pounds.
Wow.
and I was definitely not that other guy.
Right.
But once I got in there and realized that I could hang with Kevin, you know, and that we wrestled, you know, every day as, you know, friends and, but also mm-hmm. as, you know, partners and opponents, I was like, wow, man, like maybe I'm capable of doing more than I thought. And all of a sudden this dream of being a professional wrestler became something I decided that I, you know, could follow.
Oh, so when you went to Madison Square Garden, you had it in your mind that you probably wanted to try pro wrestling, or you just, or did that visit trigger?
Well, I was, you know what, I was a huge fan. Like, you know, as a comic, I think everyone's got like that moment where they realize this is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
For me, as a wrestling fan, you know, when Snuka came off the top of that cage, and you know, I the phrase I use in my book is, you know, it was like the most impressive sight I'd ever seen. He's standing up there in that cage and he's barefoot, and says, you know, his body was bathed in both blood and flash bulbs. And he took off, you know, it wasn't 15, you know, it's amazing the power of repetition. Like that 15 foot high steel cage, you go back and it's like, it's only a foot taller than he is, you know, like, but it was the majesty of the moment. And I had hitchhiked, you know, and I was by myself, you know, sitting in the sixth or seventh row.
So you're 17, 18 at the time?
I was 18.
Wow.
18, and yet when he dove off, it was like I was part of something bigger than myself, like part of a community. And I remember, like, vividly thinking, like, one day I'd like to make people feel the way that I feel right now. And
yeah.
That was the goal, like, in that. Without that moment at the Garden, you know, so many things, if, you know, hadn't been for going out for that team and going against the mighty Kevin James, or that hitchhiking experience to the Garden, you know, none of what followed would have taken place.
Well, you followed your passion, you know. I mean, I was a lawyer and a banker before I did this, and I left to be a comedian, and it was a tough choice. But, like, I think it kind of picks you. It sounds like it picked you anyway, you know what I mean? Like, it was, like you said, it was bigger than, the moment was bigger than just the moment. And when that happens, like, you're kind of sucked in whether you want to be or not, you know?
Yeah. I'd kind of given up on it. On the storytelling and the comedy. And the worst thing that could have happened to me was that I tried to become a comic, you know? And
right.
I tried to, instead of being the storyteller, I was like, okay, I got to study from these guys. And I had a set that was so painful. I mean, it hurt.
Wait. You're talking about doing stand up or wrestling?
When I did stand up, when I segued into stand up.
Oh, out of wrestling. Gotcha.
4.5 years ago, and yeah. I was going with the Wounded Warriors. I was accompanying them, and mm-hmm. I told the guy, we're at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York, and I told the guy with the Warriors, I said, hey, I used to do, you know, some stand up. If you guys want me to do a set, let me know. And I'm sitting there at the front table, you know, and then I didn't know Amy Schumer at the time, but she came out, acknowledged me, so that when I met her in Montreal a couple of years later, she's like, I saw you in the front row of the Gotham. But you know the way these showcases are, like, you don't get on these showcases unless you're really good to begin with.
Yeah.
And so Amy comes out and she kills, and then, you know, this guy is good, this guy, and then Judah comes out, and, you know, Judah does the killer 20 minutes, and then they go, hey, we have a special guest, you know, like, he's here supporting the Wounded Warriors, WWE champion Mick Foley. And I go up thinking it's going to be like a wrestling promo that I can wing.
Yeah.
And people were not buying what I thought, you know, I had to sell.
Right.
And at a certain point, I just said to the audience, I just said, if I was in a pool, I'd ask for a life preserver because I'm drowning up here.
Good for you.
And I walked out of that stage fall. I was like, I never want to go through this again. And Judah was there.
Mm.
And he goes, dude, he goes, it's not as bad as you thought. I said, Judah, come on, it was awful. He goes, dude, ordinarily if someone goes 4 straight minutes without getting a laugh, he goes, they're done. He goes, but dude, they'll listen to you. He goes, don't get me wrong, you got to find ways to make these stories funny.
Yeah.
But he kind of talked me like off the ledge, you know. And
plus you've got your audience coming to you who are wrestling fans now, as opposed to that situation.
That situation was
a bunch of
different
civilians who probably weren't necessarily pro wrestling fans per se.
Yeah, yeah. And I was trying. I mean, I had some really overarching themes. And what's funny is that when the show ended up, it did become a pretty good show. Took it to Edinburgh and Montreal. That a lot of what ended up working was stuff that I threw out there, you know, as a premise that night at Gotham. And I love it. It reminds me so much of being in the ring and wrestling, or when I was writing. Is like you come up with an idea and you don't know where it's going to end up, you know, or how you're going to use it, but you have this idea, and then when it clicks, boom, it's like, you know, it locks into place, and, you know, you get that laugh kind of off
yeah.
the cuff. And,
yeah, talk about sort of, I'm fascinated because I had this conversation with Stone Cold on the podcast about there are a lot of parallels between what stand-ups do to develop and hone and define their persona and what wrestlers do and how you walked into the business at a young age. And, you know, you've had incarnations as, you know, Mankind and Dude Love and Cactus Jack. And like how did you hit on these different personas at the different stages of your career? And when did you decide to transit, and why transition away from one to the other, and back to one? You sometimes would bring them back.
Yeah. I'm going to try to handle this. There are similarities. I'd say one of the big similarities is I've been really fortunate that when other comics see me, you know, they might be skeptical, and I've heard this from guys, like they're skeptical because there have been those, you know, those guys who were just using their time on stage to
right.
fill.
No, I hear you, but I'm not talking about your show right now. I'm talking, I mean, we could talk about that too, but I'm talking about like how that percent.
Well, what I was going to say is there's that weeding out process where guys are offering advice and you have to take what works for you, cipher it out, you know, and you decipher it and figure out, okay, how is this working for me? And when I got to WWE, I'd been Cactus Jack for 11 and a half years. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the beginning, I'd always wanted to be this wrestler called Dude Love. Mm. And Cactus Jack was supposed to be a generic name I would use until I became good enough to adopt the moniker Dude Love, and I would become the ladies' man and essentially, you know, be able to like live out a fan, you know, kind of play a character that was completely against my, I'd be like, you know, living out a fantasy. And then, as it turned out, like Mother Nature didn't quite cooperate with the Dude Love thing. And I became really comfortable and over the years, you know, really good at being this, you know, deranged Cactus Jack character.
Yeah, and you talk about Tri-State Wrestling style of wrestling suited that character really well.
Oh, yeah, man. You go back, well, that's old school. Tri-State was the precursor to ECW.
Yeah, Extreme Championship Wrestling. And what was it? So people who don't understand wrestling, you know, the way real aficionados are, there are these sort of, it's almost if I'm doing this badly, tell me, but like these sort of minor league organizations that you work your way through to get to the big time, right? And as you're working through those organizations, you're defining kind of who your character is, and you're playing and exploring and trying out, just like comedians try out bits with audiences, you're trying out moves and getting audience reactions, and you're listening and then tweaking. Is that accurate? I mean, is that?
Yeah, that's really accurate. And in the old days, the process was really cool. You know, it was different. Now there is, you know, more, you know, cooperation and mm-hmm. planning. But and I'm not saying that it was ever, you know, a true competitive thing. But, you know, when I went to Memphis, Tennessee, they were kind of tough on me. Mm-hmm. I think because I was Northern. Like, mm-hmm. That sounds weird, but that's the conclusion I've reached. But at the same time, we'd wrestle in the same city, you know, every Monday night was Memphis, every Tuesday was Louisville, every Wednesday was Evansville, Indiana, every Saturday night was Nashville. Nashville, for example, you wouldn't even see your opponent until you got in the ring. So there was impossible to, you know, to plan anything. Mm-hmm. You kind of had to work on, movement, you know, and feel. Same thing when you were in Japan and didn't speak the language, you know, you wouldn't, you know, I told my kids that maybe they were old enough to watch like my most physical disturbing matches, a match I had, in Japan in January of 1999 with Terry Funk,
right,
with an N, in case there's any FCC issues.
Now you can say whatever you can really, say whatever you want on this. Don't worry about it.
Just really wild stuff. But when I got to WWE, when I finally got that call, you know, Ms. McMahon did not tell me the reason they were going for the character change is because he just always thought I looked seedy.
Mm-hmm. and he wanted.
And I did. Yeah, yeah. He didn't. I didn't have that star look. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I
my wife's
in the other room. I believe she just got injured while assembling a Christmas tree.
And I
should yell to her. She's holding her knee.
Okay, you need.
But you're Paul Mercurio.
No. You need to take a break. You okay?
You okay? Oh, all right. She's okay.
Why are you assembling a Christmas tree in May?
It's a Foley thing. I don't know.
That's awesome, man. I want to live in your house. That's awesome. Gifts show up, wrestling rings, breakaway tables, Christmas trees are being assembled. Is there a pattern? Everybody in your family seems to get hurt doing stuff too.
It's a unique group of people.
What was the home?
Anyone who saw our episode of Celebrity Wife Swap be like, they're kind of like a freewheeling group.
Yeah,
of people,
a little bit.
All seem to get along.
When you really got into wrestling full time, what was the biggest eye opener? The physical demands? Did you think it was more show than it actually was? Was it more fake than it actually was?
Well, I found it in a hurry, you know, well before I got on the road full time, that it was, you know, far more realistic than I'd ever imagined. You know, I thought I could take my flair for the theatrics. I didn't realize at the time that I would develop this, you know, threshold for pain. It was tough, and I was not a natural to it. You know, mm-hmm. But I'd already committed to taking this drive every weekend from my college in Cortland to Pittsburgh, which is about 350 miles each way. And,
wow.
It was a hike, right on the verge of calling it quits. You know, I finally started getting the hang of it, you know, and started finding out that, I could do things that I, you know, didn't think were possible. You know, I had, you know, more skills than I had.
For instance, what are we talking about? You mean in terms of just the physical demands and the moves and all of that? And are you getting trained by somebody at this point?
Yeah. I was really fortunate. The guy who trained me, a guy named Dominic DiNucci, he'd qualified for the Italian Olympic team way back in the 50s, but mm-hmm. didn't have the money to go. And he was a guy, I remember when we went to Italy in 86, he was in his mid 50s then, and they had a big, thick Italian bodybuilder wanted to train to be a wrestler. And Dominic said, he got in the referee's position for amateur wrestling, and he said, if you can turn me, I train you. And this guy, you know, I mean, he could have probably benched for us 400 pounds or more, and it was like, it was amazing. It was like, he could not get him off his base. And so if Dominic wanted to, and this was an old school thing, like in the Carolinas, some of the stuff they did is outright cruel. You have to keep in mind that there was this whole real versus fake debate. So
right.
Part of the way they instilled respect for pro wrestling is they would take a guy, okay, you're going to train to be a wrestler, and okay, get down in the referee's position. And as soon as he got down in the referee's position, they drop a knee on his ankle and break his leg immediately. And then that was thought to be good for business because the guy would return to wherever he was from with a cast. And they'd say, how did you get that? And it was, I mean, it's like,
oh my God. So it was like, it was like advertising that this is real.
Yeah. Like in the Florida territory, the prerequisite, you know, for a job was that you'd be able to get into fights in bars and win. So that was their free advertising, was the police blotter.
Wait. So that, like, you would have to go to a bar, get in a fight, beat a guy up, get arrested, and then you'd get a job?
That's how you kept your job and you kept your position of prominence. And there were, you know, stories about, you know, back then, one of the things I do on this, you know, my current show, the Hardcore Legend Tours, I examine the idea of getting heat from the crowd how hard I had to work for it, because I was not a naturally mean person and not a naturally, like, not a natural alpha male even, you know, that I was more the guy who wanted the reactions. I was more of a performer. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I was in a business where guys literally had to fight for their lives to get out of towns, you know, where it was considered, you know, I remember my first week in Texas, it was considered like a badge of honor to get your tires slashed by fans because that proved that you had heat.
Wow.
Like, it's like a,
well, this
down,
is
like,
this is training to be a heel, right? As it's called.
Yeah. Back in the days, you know, and I learned, you know, my brush with that was when I was in Nigeria in 1987 and found out, and this is one of the few times I was in front of large crowds, you know, in those early years, but if there are 30,000 people there in a stadium and 29,999 of them are of a different color, and you are cheating using an illegal weapon to try to defeat the Nigerian champion, they don't take well to that.
You're going to have a problem. You probably want to slip out the back way.
If it hadn't been for some of the Nigerian wrestlers, like, running out, literally saving my life, you know, because I was in the process of being bludgeoned by an angry mob.
Well, talk about when you're on stage, though, and you're in the ring, and are you trying things and to get a pulse of the audience and get a sense of what they're going for, and then once you say, they're really latching... Like, you go in knowing an opponent, you're going to work the leg. You're going to work his leg, right? So you're going to work his right leg, or you've got a plan.
You might have a plan, and then you know, if you're good, you can adapt. In that way, it's very much like being on stage and seeing, you know, as a performer, like right. You are, seeing what they're buying and, you know, how drunk the audience. I mean, that's a different, you know, that's a different animal. But, you know, like Friday, you know, from what I've learned, you know, the Friday night late shows.
Yeah.
That's like, that would be like the stand-up equivalent to wrestling in Nigeria with a hostile audience. You know, like, you tread carefully.
Right.
One, here's a lesson I learned is Friday night early show in Rochester, a buddy of mine, Edge, makes the drive, and he comes out, and we do this thing, big surprise at the end, And since I usually work off nights, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Sundays, I don't have that much Friday night late show experience. Mm-hmm. And I learned in a hurry, you know, that you don't go out there and go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure if you heard it, but Edge! Everyone cheered because they'd seen the audience leaving, talking about the appearance of Edge. Edge was here. He's not here anymore, but he was awesome. Trust me, he was awesome. And it was just like this, you know, all the air being let out of the tire.
Yeah, exactly. So you're gauging the audience, and you're trying to figure out, like, when you're Cactus Jack, are you sort of you're playing this out?
Yeah. And there were some nights where you'd have a plan and you'd stick to the plan. But, you know, for example, one night I was kind of banged up in Savannah, Georgia. This is like in the early 90s. I remember my wife had a hotel room because we were spending some time together on the road. And it was anything goes match. And I was, you know, pretty famous for these things and having the real physical matches, but I thought I'd kind of give my body a break by, like, you know, using some humorous props like the plunger. Right. You know, I thought the plunger to the face, like, that's got to be good for. And they weren't buying it. Like,
really? I mean, it worked for the Three Stooges. Come on.
You would think, right? Yeah. Time tested. Mo Howard, it ought to work for us. And they just weren't in that mood to buy the funny stuff. So, you know, you call the audible and, you know, you go into a more serious mode. And I remember that night, you know, almost, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, you know, almost crawling back to the room. But I was like, I got him, you know. But it's almost like Daffy Duck, you know, when he has that big contest with Bugs.
Right.
And as Bugs has to admit defeat, and Daffy's ascending to heaven playing that harp, and he has that great line where he goes, I know, but I can only do it once.
did you, so the comedy was a somewhat it was part of experimentation, but it seemed to connect, it seemed to work and stick for you because you went back to it and you were one of the few guys that were able to pull it off on a consistent basis. And why do you think that was? Because it was such a juxtaposition to how violent you were.
Yeah, well, here's the like the irony to me is I did inject a little bit of humor, and there was a famous saying that Paul Heyman, who's a great one of the great microphone men in history, you call it make them laugh and cut them off, and he would use as an example the guy in Full Metal Jacket, the sergeant. I think his name is Early Ermey.
Earl. I know you're talking about Earl something.
Ermey, yeah. And he would be so funny, in a cruel way. And then he just crossed that line where you actually felt bad about laughing. He would make you laugh and cut you off. So
right.
I had some experience with that, but it wasn't until after that cell match that, I came home and I was in rough shape for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I have two kids and this is my living. I've got to find a way to connect with audiences, above and beyond the physical.
Right.
And that's when I really started lightening up the character of Mankind and incorporating a lot more humor. And to this day, the two things I'm asked about the most are, it's the cell match in 98 and then my my teaming with The Rock in 99 as The Rock and Sock Connection.
Right.
And by that point, the character was really, really lighthearted, almost Muppet-like, and the two of us, without any scripting, were able to really just riff off each other
mm-hmm.
in a way that, people remember 15 years after the fact. So, I went to comedy because it was, it was a way of extending, my livelihood for a couple extra years.
How real was the feud with Flair? Was it real?
You know a lot, huh?
I'm sure,
Rick, there was some hard feelings stemming from my autobiography. I still maintain, if Rick had read it, that instead of having the bad parts pointed out to him,
right.
That the lines like, "Hey, no matter what I say about Ric Flair, I'll always be proud of the fact that he was the Nature Boy who brought me into WCW."
Right.
Statement about him as my boss. There was a lot of positive things about him as a wrestler and as a person as well. There was some real life friction there, but we were able to take that, a few years later and really create some magic, in the ring and especially on the microphone. So we would be given, 10 minutes. And I remember Terry Taylor, who was the head of talent relations in Total Nonstop Action. He goes, "Okay, you guys have 10 minutes. Just you and Rick go out there and do that thing that only the two of you understand."
Yeah. Well, you're really known for, good microphone work. Apparently, your promo work for ECW was, still to this day considered to be, one, the best ever in wrestling history. You had these anti-hardcore promos where you criticized the fans and were
Oh yeah, yeah. I got pretty deep, because you couldn't go the regular avenue of just the great heat of old days. Rick Ruth was a great heel, and he goes, for you all you fat out of shape, Scranton sweat hogs, keep the noise. That's great.
Right.
But you couldn't go after the ECW audience like that. Be like, "Yeah, that's us."
So what would you say? I mean, what were some of the things you were saying?
Learned the lessons from the great bad guys of the past. And the guy I always quoted was Michael Hayes of the Freebirds, who said, "No matter how warped the logic, the heel, the bad guy has to believe he's right."
Right.
And so at the time, remember that young man in Singapore, they caned him across the hands or the buttocks. Shoplifting.
Yeah.
And so the time-honored martial arts training tool, the kendo stick, became the Singapore cane, because that's the way we roll in wrestling. And so to say caning someone, it was a verb.
Yeah.
And there was a fan out in the audience when I was a good guy, and he had a sign that said "Cane Dewey." and Dewey was my son. He was 3 years old. And when I told my wife about the sign, like I thought, you know, I, in a weird way, I was like, okay, that's funny, Kane Dewey, because I was a guy who talked about his real life, you know, kids and real life problems, and I think that's why a lot of people associate with me. They knew that, although what they saw in the ring may have been, you know, performance, that the emotions were always real,
right?
Were usually real, that fueled them. And my wife, you know, she nearly threw up. She goes, I almost got sick to my stomach. And so a week or two later, I was asked how I'd feel about, you know, turning heel, which was thought to be impossible because I was kind of a beloved personality in that hardcore atmosphere. And I thought about it, like, okay, what would cause me to, you know, what would cause that? And I just thought about that sign. And you know, I went out there, you know, nothing written down, nothing, just some ideas. I thought about it, and, you know, I cut this, you know, what they call the, it actually is a T-shirt. You can buy it on Amazon. Kane Dewey, a T-shirt, you know, cut, you know.
Oh, really?
19 years ago, yeah, in the basement of the cameraman's house while his mom was, you know, doing the ironing. You know, really just took some of that real life, you know, anger and channeled it. And, you know, I say now, like, if there'd been Twitter, you know, back then, I would have been out of a job, because now you get mad at somebody and you go, you stink, you know, you get it out of your system. Whereas then it'd be like, all right, I'm going to hold on to this.
Yeah,
and hold on to it. I'm gonna let it brew, and then it's gonna just come pouring out.
And once you
promo.
Once you became the heel, I mean, you could never really go back from that, right? I mean, is that a obviously you made hay with it and tremendous success with it. Were you ever wishing that you weren't the heel? And how did Mankind come about in terms of? I know that McMahon wanted you to be Mason.
Mason the Mutilator? Mason. Man, you've done your homework.
if you're nice enough to give me the time, that's the least I can do. And you wanted Mankind because you felt that that was sort of, it spoke to like a larger audience somehow.
Yeah, and that it would be a double meaning. And I also thought Mason the Mutilator would be the kiss of death, you know, like no matter how good the performance was. And I used Stone Cold as an example because when, you know, he came in as the ringmaster and he was obviously, you know, he was, you know, incredibly talented and he'd had a nice run with WCW as Stunning Steve Austin, but the ringmaster wasn't clicking.
Right.
And he went to the, you know, Vince with the idea of, you know, using this kind of cold-blooded guy. And,
yeah, he says that what they played off of was Vince told him he to do stuff, and he was anti-authoritative and sort of that. He picked up on that and kind of that drove the Stone Cold.
Oh, it did. But in the beginning, when the creative team got the, this is why you always got to be thinking for yourself. You know, they got the cold word, and like they came up with all these things that had to do with like temperature.
Oh.
So it was like. You know, Chili McFreeze. You know, and I say, like, to this day, if he'd come out as Ice Dagger, same thing, you know, same music, same guy, dead, because it's just the worst name in the world. So, you know, I came up with Mankind, you know, to put before the Mutilator. And, you know, I remember, you know, going in and just pitching all these ideas to Mr. McMahon. He just nodded his head and you know, and I didn't know how many of them, if any, they were going to pick up on. But, you know, when I came out for that first match, I was just Mankind. There was no Mutilator. You know, they went with the separate entrance and exit themes. And, I, you know, I had enough confidence at that point where I really thought I had something worth saying. And, you know, sometimes that drives WWE crazy because I still feel like I have things that are worth saying. And now, like I said, now that you got social media, if I'm angry about, you know.
Well, you just made a comment recently about, you know, the stock price of WWE. And you wrote on your Facebook page, right, you know, that the stock price has fallen a ton. And that, you know, why not, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that you know, maybe they're the on-screen antics of some of the executives is hurting the stock price.
That's, you know, that's probably a and I even mentioned it's a, probably a minor reason.
Yeah.
But you know, for people who say, "Oh, come on, that's ridiculous," everyone knows that they're. I'm like, no, I don't think, you know. And other people say, people who don't know the difference don't buy stock. And I would say, no, actually, people who buy stock, like major stock, look at, you know, earnings and shit. Like, they look at those numbers. They don't, they're not, the guy who watches the show buys the stock to say, hey, I own part of the company. The guys who really invest are looking at those other numbers.
Revenue float, yeah.
And I'm just like, I'm just trying to think, all right, imagine if, you know, if you don't, if you're not looking at wrestling as a fan, but you're looking at it as a business, and you tune in and you see the real-life chief operating officer handcuffing and berating and beating the dog poop out of an employee, and you have the boss's daughter, you know, the chief branding officer, Stephanie, who's a wonderful human being, but she does a great job of that microphone just being a hideous human being. And I'm like saying, well, imagine if you, like, you didn't understand, you didn't get that, okay, in wrestling, the real life owners can play characters.
Right.
And you thought, like, hey, Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, he's just playing a character. Like, he's just playing the racist owner of the Clippers. You know, this is, I just thought, it's the only business in the world where we expect shareholders to understand.
So understand that. It's it'd be like seeing like the president of the CEO of GE come out and just slam a puppy with a hit or pelt kittens with light bulbs or something. And you're like, yeah, okay, is this really what?
Can I just say, mentioned that I bought the stock. I think it's tremendously undervalued. It is a great company, and I think that stock is going to jump. You know, it was a precipitous drop, you know, based on, you know, some, you know, bold moves that didn't quite come to fruition yet. But I did just ponder out loud. Like, that was one of those thoughts I had. And instead of just having a thought, now I've got a way to get it out there, which is a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, that's the beauty of social media. You were in the Beyond the Mat documentary. How was that? Was it too intrusive, or was it a fun experience in some ways?
No, I mean, you know, I really thought that was what I would be remembered for. When I remember getting a knock on my door.
It's really good. People should see it if they haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's really good. You know what's funny is when Judah Friedlander took me to visit the set of 30 Rock, and he introduced me to Alec Baldwin. Alec came out, and he was just like stunned, and he'd just seen the documentary, and he kept asking about my kids if they're okay, and and I'm like, yeah, they're fine. And then it was like 2 days later, Judah's like, dude, I don't think Alec realizes that film is 15 years old, like, because I look basically the same, and my kids, you know, they did come around.
Yeah.
To quote John Candy, you know, kids are resilient.
Yeah.
Just came around and started talking after a couple of weeks. But when I got involved with Beyond the Mat, it was literally a knock on the door, and I got a phone call from this guy named Barry Bloom, who was the agent for Jesse Ventura, the first wrestler to ever have, you know, official management.
Oh, yeah.
That was like crazy. Like, Jesse Ventura shows up in 1992 in WCW, and he's got representation. People are like, what the, you know, come on, what are you, you know, who do you think you are? And he knocked on the door. He said, hey, I'm going to bring this director by. Would you be willing to talk to him? And at the time, I'd left WCW.
Mm-hmm.
And so my role in this Beyond the Mat was going to be the guy who'd had a taste of stardom and was now back to, like, square one, you know, working the independents.
Right.
And fortunately, you know, as the movie progressed, you know, my fate's changed. And to this day, like, you know, Mr. McMahon does not like the film.
Why?
And it's primarily because he doesn't want, he believes in the magic, you know, in taking people's minds off their problems.
Right.
And I think he thinks it hurts, you know, it hurts that
magic. He doesn't think that people don't know that it's scripted. And I mean,
no, but he does. But he thinks, you know, like if you see the real life problems, I mean, that's what, you know, we had this discussion a long time ago.
It's the same thing with the NFL, right?
Like, same thing with the NFL and the concussions. And believe it or not, not that I'm trying to go back and make a gratuitous pitch for my Santa Claus documentary, even though it's going to surprise a lot of people. But there's some anger in the Santa community, primarily because of those same subjects that, hey, it's supposed to be magic. Like, we're not supposed to know that, you know, this guy is, you know, counting on his job to, you know, to keep his home, or that another guy, you know, works the entire year, you know, just for that, you know, 1 month, or the idea that one of our Santas is gay has caused an uproar, you know, even though he's the nicest guy in the world. So, So I see a lot of similarities, but that documentary turned out. I loved it. To this day, I love it.
Yeah,
I keep in touch with the director, and that was, you know, I met him in '95. So we've kept in touch all these years.
Was there ever this is a 2-part question? Like, when you got your ear ripped off, is that one of the moments where you're going, "Geez, what am I doing here?" And then the other was, was there ever a stunt or a gimmick that you really wanted to do that you never got to do? Either you got talked out of, or your wife talked you out of it, or McMahon wouldn't let you do it? Or
I'll answer that. You know, after losing my ear, first of all, I didn't realize this is what another thing we're learning about concussions is that there is this almost instantaneous adrenaline rush you get. So that sometimes, unless it's a major concussion where you're out, like, you don't realize you've done damage to your brain because the adrenaline rush is kind of masking it. And it's not until a day or two later that you have that drop off. You know, like, we're learning a lot as we go. But when you're injured, like I was in Germany, the two things going through my mind were, A, that there was that guy in the U.S. named John Wayne Bobbitt.
Had a
successful
tip of his penis snipped off.
And he had that reattached, so I wasn't so worried. And then seriously, like I was like, you know, in going for the ride in the ambulance, and I was, what had me like kind of, you know, kind of excited was like, man, I'm in the only business where losing an ear is not necessarily a bad thing, you know.
Right.
But think of the interviews I can do. And so it wasn't until I found out that they just weren't going to do anything with it, you know, that I, you know, like, I got really down. It was like, oh, come on. I mean, that's essentially why I left the company. It's like, if they can't figure out what to, you know, do something with this, you know, like, I just don't see myself having a future in that company. That's why, you know, that's honestly why I left.
You're literally sacrificing your, you know, pieces of your body, and they, was there ever something that you like conceptualized?
Oh, yeah, the big move. You know, what's funny is I just had a couple of guests on stage with me in Tampa. That's one of the things I love doing is, you know, if I can find a friend of mine, someone who's instrumental in my career, you bring them up for the Q&A. We do, you know, I do about an hour and 20-minute show, and about 20 minutes of it is Q&A. And so Jerry Briscoe was in the front office of WWE, and he remembered the conversation exactly. I didn't know that he went to Mr. McMahon because of my opening night with WWE. I'd always wanted to drop an elbow off the TV truck onto an opponent on a parked car, because I thought, A, you get the great camera shot, you know, coming down, like literally, like flying into people's living rooms. And B, I thought the shock absorbers of the car would give a little bit and make it, you know, a move I could do, you know, make it like worthwhile on the Foley risk reward ratio spectrum.
Right.
That'd be a lot of bang, you know, for the buck.
Right.
And then Jerry Briscoe said to me, you know, he came back. I didn't realize he talked to Mr. Mann. He goes, you know, we are aware that you do a lot of strange things, and there may come a time when we will ask you to do some of that, but please don't do it until, you know, until it's time. And just last night, you know, it's really cool to come back and to watch the WWE Network with my son, who's a huge fan at age 11, and he watched WWE Countdown. It was like the 10 most memorable debuts, and I came in at number 9, the debut against The Undertaker, attacking The Undertaker. And it was, you know what? It was really memorable even without the elbow off the truck. But that was the one thing. Like, every year or so, I'd be like, how about the elbow off the TV truck? You know, like, and every year or so, it'd be shot down.
They nixed it. Well, but that, maybe you should do that. You should do that outside in the parking lot after one of your live shows.
Oh, my
on the
body
tour.
Is shot. That's the... that's the only thing, is that apparently there's a downside to doing these things.
God. You pussy.
So
walk it off, you pussy. Listen up. People need to go see you. RealMickFoley.com is your website with all of your tour dates. You need to go see the show. I've seen it. It's really terrific. It's really entertaining. It's not like anything else that's out there. It's from the heart, but it's fun. And obviously such a great guy and so well-spoken and such a, obviously a great father, bringing gifts home for your kids, even though your wife is writhing in pain and you didn't leave the interview. I like how that you're committed to your art. I appreciate that.
I'll tell you how committed I am to my art, Paul. This is something I wouldn't do anywhere else. I'm in the Foley urine room. This is where our untrained dog Randall stays. It just reeks of urine. I've been in here this entire time.
You're a stud. You're a stud. Go take a shower after this. Mick Foley, thanks, man, for doing this. And, you know, I want to do another one of these with you because there's a lot more I want to talk to you about and catch up and just keep track of how your tour's going. So we'll do another one.
Yeah, hey, I appreciate it. We'll do it a few months down the road. Thanks for the time, Paul. I really appreciate
absolutely.
It for doing
thanks.
Your homework, too.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I'm a big fan, and it's an honor to have you on. Go check him out on tour, realmickfoley.com. Talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, thanks.
All right, so that was Mick Foley. After the conversation was done, we got naked and wrestled, and I kicked his ass. That's right. No, I hope you enjoyed it. I think just a really articulate guy who has a lot of interesting stuff to say about the world in general and that world of wrestling, which I think is endlessly fascinating and has a lot of interesting backstory to it. So I hope you enjoyed it. I sure did. And check me out doing stand-up this week, May 29th to the 31st. I'm going to be at the West Palm Beach Improv in West Palm Beach, Florida. So if you're in that area, please come out and check out a show. And June 26th to the 29th, I will be at the Hartford Funny Bone in Hartford, Connecticut. Also, I got a special live taping that we're filming for television and the web June 10th here in New York City at 8:30 p.m. at the Comedy Cellar at the Village Underground. My guest will be Gilbert Gottfried, a legend in comedy. It's going to be hilarious, and there'll be a live audience there, and we're going to have a lot of fun. It's going to be great energy. So come on out, June 10th, 8:30 p.m. here in New York City. Comedy Cellar at the Village Underground. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com, for details.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all our turf.